And we've seen the photographs, and, you know, clearly she was a very beautiful young woman.
Yes. A typical Edwardian lady in some respect.
Yeah.
Progressive.
Yeah.
Yeah. She...
Well, she watched The Shoulder to Shoulder, and she read Miss Antonia Raeburn's book. Mm. And she insists that there were a number of omissions there.
Does she? I imagine one of the omissions is the Women's Freedom League.
Well, as a matter of fact, I was looking at the book again the other day, and I haven't got a copy, but I saw one. And of course, it is called The Militant Suffragettes, and Mother was not a militant.
Yes.
See, the Freedom League was a non-militant branch of it.
Yes.
So possibly the omissions were justified there. But she said in Shoulder to Shoulder, of course, it was more the story of the Pankhursts than the story of the suffragette movement, because there were a lot of people who
were. Yes, it seemed to me they picked out the most dramatic parts of the story and not actually the parts which really actually influenced events.
But they wanted people to watch, I suppose they needed something rather compelling, magnetic.
Yeah. She did actually see it, did she? I mean, you felt she saw it.
Oh, she was able at that time to see. It was 2 or 3 years ago, wasn't it? She followed it.
Can you tell me anything about her parents? I didn't gather anything from the documents quite where she came from and what her parents were
like. Well, she was born in Prestwich, near Manchester. And I know very little of her parents because when she was young, I think her mother had not been able to cope. There were three sons besides mother. I remember her mother, a little old lady. And my mother was sent to live with an aunt and uncle from an early age. And she was rather doted on there. And when the aunt died, she more or less was the lady of the house. So I really don't know much about the background.
So she looked after your uncle, did she?
Yes, and she lived in Manchester. And what school she went to, I don't know. But she went to Stockwell Training College and took her teaching certificate from there, and then went to Hyde Grammar School as a maths teacher. And she used to tell me, you know, how it's the same stories one hears over and over again. She used to tell me that one of the men there was unable to control his class, and how she was often called in, I think it was a mixed grammar school, to impose order. Mother had quite a way with her in those days, but she could have done. She was, you know, we children were always very much in awe of her as a youngster.
Were you? Yes.
Very much.
You say we children. How many were there of you, actually?
I have one sister still alive, and my brother died in 1959, and I'm the eldest of three.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And my brother and I have always been interested in politics, and my sister not so much. She lives in Leicester. Do you take sugar?
Yes, thank you.
So that's as much of the background as I can tell you about. I don't think that her relatives were particularly interested in the movement, but she came in contact with it in Manchester, you see, which was the home of Pankhursts.
That's where her uncle and aunt lived.
Her uncle and aunt lived outside, but she was her family lived in Blakely, that's right. Blakely, Manchester, that's... it was in the country in those days. I think it's a built-up area now.
Did she keep in touch with her brothers and sisters?
She kept in touch with her younger brother until he died about 1960. He was in the First World War, was gassed, and had a lung complaint all his life. And I think it was about 1960. No, it was long before 1960. I'm dreaming. Mm. It must have been in the late 1940s when he died.
Yes.
And the others, I don't know. Oh, I have a cousin Brian, who was this younger brother's son, and he's a surgeon. He was in charge of the teaching section at Newcastle University, and he's at the moment in Canada. But I've only met him once years ago.
She kept in touch anyway, did she, with her relatives like that?
And she has a sister-in-law who's still alive.
Has she?
Younger. she's not a contemporary. She'd be about 10 years younger than Mother.
Mm.
And she writes, but Mother stopped writing letters now. She can't.
Of course.
Yeah. I have to help her to sign checks. I mean, she has to sign a residence check every so often, and that's all she can do now.
Mm.
And Christmas cards I send off for her and that kind of thing.
Mm.
But you may be able to stimulate her memory, you know.
Mm.
I mean, you've done a lot of interviewing, you know how to tackle it.
Yes. Well, I mean, I'll be very much guided by you as regards how long I go on and what I ask and that sort of thing. But can you tell me a bit about her husband? And when did she marry? And
about
who?
My father.
Yes.
My favourite. Well, my father was 48 when he married her.
Was he really?
He'd be 112 now, I think, if he were alive.
Mm.
But he was a keen labour man, and he was, at the time he met her, he was a very wealthy coal exporter, a merchant, Ronnebeck and Company, a big merchanting firm in Middlesbrough. And Mother came into the area as WFL organiser, and she spoke at Gisborough in the marketplace. It's a county, a small country town outside Middlesbrough, and she had rotten eggs and things thrown at her, and I think my father was one of the people who sort of went to protect and rescue her. And it started then. She married in 1910. And he, well, let's say, always did things in a very big way, but he never considered the details. And he more or less started the Labour Party in Middlesbrough. And then in 1924, when the German mark was in a parlous condition, he embarked on some speculation. They sent a tremendous load of coal, I think, to Germany, and they got paid for it in the depreciated marks, and he lost everything in 1924, absolutely everything. When I was a child, I remember reading the storybooks of the period, one by Francis Hodgson Burnett, about a little girl whose father lost his fortune while she was out in India, and it was one of the things that never happened to oneself.
Mm.
Well, in the event, of course, my father was left more or less penniless. And he lived till 1939, but he was always working for somebody else in a very small way then.
As a merchant or
an agent, a business agent, you know,
yes,
the connection he'd had in the past, I suppose, helped a little.
Yes.
But he really did. He toppled from there to there.
Yes.
And he always stuck to his principles. I remember I was in France in 1930. I was taking modern languages at the university, and I was doing a short period in France at the time when the national government came in with Ramsay MacDonald.
Yeah.
And I was with people who, of course, were delighted that that had happened, and I was a bit too young, really, I suppose, to consider the implications. Shouldn't have been. And I wrote a letter home saying how pleased I was. Oh, thanks very much. And I got a letter from my father explaining the situation from A to Z and pointing out that I'd got quite the wrong end of the stick, that Ramsay MacDonald had deserted the cause, and the people who mattered were Lansbury and those who had not gone along those lines. And of course, that brought me back to my senses. And then after that, of course, I became equally interested and followed Attlee's career.
Mm.
Attlee, of course, was outstanding.
Yes, yeah, remarkable.
At the time, sorry, we're doing the same thing. Everybody thought that Attlee was a nonentity, but in the event he's proved to be.
Oh, I think, I mean, looking back, that ministry was a great ministry, actually.
Yes.
But he,
I heard him speak in Middlesbrough Town Hall at the time that he was had this reputation of being.
Honestly.
Yes. And I was most impressed.
Mm.
Most impressed. It was 1945.
Mm.
And, you know, one felt that the nation could be guided by a man like that.
Mm. Well, I think he was a great man, actually, in a very quiet, unpretentious way.
To finish about my father, evidently his people had been Quakers, and he never was a religious man himself, but I think when he was young, he belonged to the Quaker calling. But the Unitarians in Middlesbrough were keenly... the clergyman, who was now dead, was a keen Labour man. And when my father died, he approached me and said, I'd like to take the service. And he had... I remember the funeral was followed by hundreds of people in Middlesbrough.
Was it?
Who remembered what my father had done for the poor folk in Middlesbrough when he was able to. And Mr. Reed, who took the sermon, he's since dead himself. He was an engineer by profession, and then he'd gone into Unitarianism. And he held the church together, but when he left it, it tumbled.
But why did your father, do you think, intervene in defence of your mother? I mean, was he that type of person? Was he rather quixotic sort of person, or very chivalrous or anything like that? I mean,
I don't know a great deal about his early days. My Aunt Marion, who's, you know, Marion Coates Hansen,
yes,
the picture you saw there.
Yes.
Don't know. He was born, by the way, in York.
Was he?
My husband and I, last year, were trying to find the place. We found the street, but it's been built over, of course, since then. And I think he'd moved with progressive people. I don't know if you know much about American history at the time, but Joseph Fells.
Oh, yes, the businessman. Fells Nackerman, yes.
Was a very keen social reformer. And my father's second brother, there was one older and the next one younger, became a sort of English agent for Joseph Fells. He made a lot of money himself. And my Aunt Marion met the Fellses and went to stay out in America with them for some time. And the connection brought a young man from America called Norman Olmeyer into the Ronnebeck firm. They were all social reformers, and I think that they didn't actually hit the Bloomsbury group, but there was a connection. I think they met the Webbs and that sort of thing. I know my father had a big library of Webb books. I've kept a few of them, but, you know, we had practically all that the Webbs wrote.
Only, I mean, in a way, superficially, it's rather odd, isn't it, for a coal merchant to be a keen socialist, and one would expect, you know...
Come along and have some coffee.
Employer. Thank you very much. An employer to be on the other side. I mean, can you explain why he should take the position he did? I suppose
well,
it's very difficult
quite a number of wealthy people in the 19th century did that kind of thing, didn't they?
Yes.
But my father wasn't wealthy as a younger man. I mean, he was a self-made man. He left school and he was
Thank
deaf.
Thank you very much, yes.
Became an office boy.
Did he?
And went to the Mechanics Institute and that sort of thing, and read.
Did he?
Well, he told me all the Dickens stories when I was a child, and he could quote Shakespeare.
Yeah.
These people who educated themselves in the 19th century learned far more than lots of people who have
university
education
in the present
period. It's a fact.
Well, you educate yourself more thoroughly if you're doing it by your own efforts, you know, in your spare time and so on, I think, in the world.
Have a chocolate biscuit. Those are things I've got. Coffee.
Yes, I'd love to try one of these. I haven't seen these. I think I'm making rather a pig of myself.
Not at all. You've had a long journey.
Incidentally, well, I think it was... I mean, Fells was a very interesting man because he's a soap manufacturer, isn't he, in fact, and is connected with many sort of labour and sort of early socialist activities. It's rather interesting to see your
paths
mixed up.
When Lenin came through this country in a train, you know, to go to Russia in 1917, he'd evidently been helped by various associations and individuals. And I always remember this being impressed on me as a young woman, that the only debt that the Soviets ever repaid in this country was to Joseph Fells for money that he'd given to Lenin to help him.
It's rather
interesting. These things that never come into history books, but carried on by word of mouth.
Did your mother and father marry very soon after they met then?
I think they must have done, because she was an organiser for about 4 years, I think. So she was about 28. But she married at 29. And you see, she'd been in prison when she was 28, and she didn't know my father until then. I think it was quite a rapid courtship. They were married in Redcar, Coatham. She'd been speaking in Redcar, married in Coatham Church.
So then she settled in Middlesbrough with your father. And did she then give up?
No, she undertook several undertakings. She remained honorary secretary, or she had an honorary position in the Freedom League. It's in these various booklets, I think. But she had an office in what was called the Arcade in Middlesbrough. And we're all vegetarians, by the way.
Are you really?
Yes. Mm. She ran a health food restaurant in the Arcade. And the upstairs room, they let off for meetings, and Mother had an office there with the secretary, Miss Bars, and they organised Freedom League meetings there. And the Freedom League in Middlesbrough went on until about 1948, because I used to go, Mother was president in perpetuity, and it got smaller and smaller, but people came in from round about, and then it was dissolved, because, you know, we just couldn't continue to organise. It was just shortly after.
This sort of restaurant thing, was it a money-making thing, really?
No, my father just poured money into it. They had a manageress, a Jewish woman, Miss Smith, I remember her quite clearly. But they never made money, and he always paid the bills.
And what was the idea, to sort of spread vegetarian eating?
Yes, well, it was all connected, you see, with women's suffrage and progressive ideas generally, and socialism. I mean, we had lots of people in Middlesbrough, who were members of the Labour Party, not the poorer ones, but for idealistic reasons, who were also interested in women's suffrage and in health foods. Well, Mother's, of course, was an ethical line, but it had to be run, of course, with health foods and that kind of thing. So she got a bit of support that would be, I suppose, around about 1918. And it would go on till about 1923, I think. It was shortly before my father lost his money.
I see, so that finished it.
That finished it, absolutely.
Yes. So it was a sort of meeting place for progressive people, was it, in a way? I mean, in the locality.
Yes.
That's very true. So did she manage that personally? I mean,
well, she had this manageress, but she used to go down. Mother always did everything on the great lady scale. No, she never liked housework or anything like that.
Didn't she really?
No, and we had a maid, and so she couldn't manage one, and so on. But she, housework was always for somebody else. I think it was an attitude in those days. You see, they were able to have domestic servants, and those are things of the past now, and rightly so.
So, as long as you can remember, when you were being brought up in the family, there were servants, were there?
Yes. I suppose I'd be about 12 when everything went fuck, but we had the best of everything in those days. It's when, on reflection, you know, it seems rather strange. Do, you know, have as many as you like.
Yes, I mean, that whole world seems most peculiar now, doesn't it? I mean,
yes, well, it went in between the wars, really. It was finished. And prior to the First World War, it must have been as different as living in Mars, almost.
So anyway, when she married your father, she had 3 children, was it?
Yes.
Fairly quickly, did she?
Yes.
And then?
My sister, who's still living, is 5 years my junior, and Peter came in between. And that was it. She used to go up and down to London a lot, even during the First World War, because she was on the National Executive of the WFL. And I remember her telling me in 1917 about the bringing down of an airship off Hartlepool. She was in the train at the time, near Northallerton, I think, and they pulled up, and she said it was a tremendous sight, seeing this thing coming down in the sky.
Yes, well, they were such big things, among other things, weren't they? But, incidentally, one of the things...
The National Treasurer was Dr. Elizabeth Knight, who knew Mother very well. Dr. Knight was killed in a motoring accident. The dates are in here somewhere. And Miss Florence Underwood was the secretary.
Yes.
And mother was president 1 year. Now, another of the presidents was Miss Marion Reeves, who ran the Minerva Club in London. Now, when I first went up to London University, I had rooms in the Minerva Club.
Did you?
And some of these people then were middle-aged women, and they used to come in, you see, and I saw Charlotte Marsh and others, but,
see?
You know, at a distance. Mm. The Minerva Club was bombed during the war and exists no more, but it was at the end of Judd Street, which goes down to King's Cross in Brunswick Square. Now, Miss Reeves died, I think, about 1963 in Ireland. Reevey, they called her. And there was another one whose name has never appeared in any of the notices that I've ever seen, Anna Munro. Now, Miss Munro, who became Mrs. Ashman, and called herself Miss Munro Ashman, was a keen, you know, she carried banners and things. Mm. And she went to live near Reading at Padworth.
Oh, yes. Oh,
had a son and a daughter, both of whom I met many years ago. And she went on for years on the National Executive and a very keen suffragist, writing, attending meetings, more so than mother, who had a streak in her character which said, oh, sit back, you can set things going and other people will carry them out. Now, Miss Munro did things, and she's never been mentioned anywhere, and I thought she should be mentioned. She's in the role of honour, but Mrs. Munro Ashman, her daughter's still alive.
As you're mentioning, I mean, about them in the home, I mean, you said your mother didn't really do very much sort of domestic work. I mean, can you describe... No more, thank you, but do carry on yourself. How do you remember her in the house as a child? I mean, how did she spend her time? How did she spend her day?
Well, in the first house we went into, she had what was called the morning room, where she had a desk and had all her letters and things, and occasionally this secretary who was down at the arcade, Miss Bars, used to come up and see her. they were always invited out to local functions. Of course, eventually she got on the council herself. I always remember her as a pretty woman with beautiful clothes. And as I grew older, I became a little afraid of her. I always loved my father very much. And he was devoted to her. He'd have done anything for her. And of course, when he lost his money, he felt that he'd let her down. And, well, I suppose when I got to be about 10 or 11, I had a dreadful feeling that I realised these, you know, gulfs between domestic servants and people in the house and that sort of thing, which were very obvious, even though they were both socialists. Mm-hmm. My father never showed any of it, but mother had to run the house, and I noticed that. And then, of course, when we eventually lost servants, well, she could help with the housework. She didn't want to. For a very short time, we ran a boarding house in Middlesbrough, pet paying guests, and mother used to have a breakfast in bed, and, you know, we did the chores and so on. But all that, I think, was part of this Victorian idea of the lady that couldn't leave her. But mentally, of course, and seeing into the future and an understanding of the economic situation and the political situation, she was outstanding. Mm. So, you see, there were compensations for...
Of course, yes. I mean, I suppose there would be feminist reasons, wouldn't there, for not doing the housework as well? I mean...
Very much so. Very much so, because it had always been regarded as a women's province, and they were out to prove it wasn't. I don't know how the other suffragettes reacted at home, but I know that that was mother's reaction, and I think you put your finger on the point.
How did they divide? I mean, presumably neither your father nor your mother did much work in the house because there were these servants. I mean, it's not that your father took over some of the things that were traditionally done.
He couldn't even have boiled an egg in later life. We always looked after him. Yeah. It never happened.
It sounds as if the children did most of the work.
No, I wouldn't say that at all, because Until I got married, mother always had a, I suppose, got maid of all work. Dreadful, and I think of it, 12 shillings a week. But that's what they did. They came, and mother occasionally did a spot of cooking. I don't want to be too critical, but it was just the way she'd been brought up, you know.
Yes, Did she get on with the servants, do you think? I mean,
she rubbed them up.
Did she really?
Yes.
Yes.
That was just as it happened.
Yes.
But she was so much, you see, the intellectual superior, and she wasn't able to come down to their level any more than she was to the children. We were afraid of her.
It's rather interesting, because, I mean, a socialist, you would have thought, I mean, again, it's one of these rather superficial contradictions, but you would have thought that the socialist would get on very well with the servants.
Yes, well, I suppose people are as they're made, and she'd been very spoiled as a young woman.
By her uncle and aunt,
you
mean?
Mm.
Yes, yes.
But she did a tremendous amount of good work for women, in that she got things going. Mm. Just to recollect one thing. You see, she left the council at the time of my father's losing his money. Now she represented us again for Grove Hill. I think that was much later.
Yes.
But she was eventually defeated on the council, and she went back as a co-opted member after 1945,
yes,
when the Labour,
yes,
Party took over. Now, in the very early 1960s, or before, you know, these responsibility allowances in teaching came in. She was co-opted onto the Education Committee. And I didn't get to parity until 1963. I think that was the date when we eventually arrived at equal pay. But the responsibility allowances came in shortly before. And some authorities paid their women 4/5 of the men's rate. Now, mother was instrumental in seeing that when they were introduced in Middlesbrough, women got the same as men for these, they call them SR allowances in those days.
Mm.
And she was supported in that by the leader of then opposition, which were the Conservatives, Jack Brown, who was very far-sighted, more far-sighted than some of his Labour colleagues on the council.
Mm.
And he supported her, even though the chairman of the Education Committee was a Labour man, was very much against women being regarded as equal. He was very unfriendly.
So she's really doing her bits right the way up to the end.
Right the way up to the end, she was. I'd say she retired from public life practically altogether in 1958. She went down to Derby to live with my brother, but he died the next year. And when she came back, my husband and I bought her a bungalow in just opposite where the home is now. A very nice home it is, too. And when she went into the bungalow in 1960, she was invited to open a clinic. And I've got the brochure about it here. 1961.
Mm.
That would be her last official job, I think.
Mm.
And for a long, long time, of course, she was extremely interested in public affairs. And the local Labour Party met at her bungalow, the ward party, for quite a while after that. And then she left there in 1969, and that was really,
How has she taken getting older? I mean, how's it gone, so to speak?
Well, she's always, been resentful against me that I didn't stay at home and look after her, you see. I got married.
What, as an unmarried daughter?
Yes. That's always been tacitly understood between us. And I know, but it was an attitude in those days, Mr. Harrison.
But I mean, you would have thought a feminist would certainly not share those attitudes.
Yes.
She'd want her daughter to go out and have opportunities and all that. Still.
And so getting old, she's been a bit resentful. Even though I've supported her at every turn, anyhow, you know. I have my moments when I feel annoyed about it, but when I consider what she's done for her bit in the feminist movement,
one gets a sort of distance from one's parents, and one begins to balance
generation
up the virtues and unvirtues when one gets older.
I think it means more when you're younger, this generation gap.
Yes.
When you can sort of look
you move to a sort of tolerance, don't you?
Yes.
when you're after your 20s, sort of thing, which you didn't have before. I mean, certainly it was the same with my parents, actually. But still, it does sound as if you had something to put up.
Well, when I was in my 20s, I was also, you know, what shall I say, very much overshadowed by my mother. I used to go with her to meetings, and I got on to Labour Party executive in Middlesbrough for a while. But I, you know, always sort of felt in the background. A long time, I felt a bit resentful about it, and then I realised afterwards why worry, you know.
What ideas did she have for your career then? Presumably no ideas for career.
Well, of course, she hadn't expected this to happen, and they were very tolerant. They would have let us go our own ways. My brother became a teacher. He taught at Wolverhampton Grammar School. That's where he started. Then he went to Nottingham High Patent School. He was on staff there for a while. Then he went to Derby School as chief biology man, and he died in Derby in 1945. He was 45 at the time, which was 1958. He had a heart attack. He was through the war, of course, and I think he'd had malaria, and it came back and back and back.
He was the only son.
He was the only son.
Was she very attached to him?
Yes, but I think the favourite was my sister Alice, who left us at the age of 18 to paddle her own canoe, and she went off to Birmingham first, and then Manchester, and then Leicester, where she met her husband. She felt that the other two had been educationally favoured, just as it happened.
You and your brother?
Yes, we won scholarships and things, and so on. Yeah. So, you know, I think it was the loss of the money and the loss of the status and prestige and everything that all had something to do with it. But
so she took herself off, you mean, against your mother's wishes?
Well, no, they agreed, but she was young in those days. I mean, 18 is the age of majority now, but it wasn't in those days. And they let her go. And my father died in 1939, just before the outbreak of war, which he saw coming. He hated the Munich business, Neville Chamberlain. Oh, this is, you know, après-moi le déluge sort of thing.
Did she?
Yes. No, they agreed politically. Mm. They saw eye to eye. Mm. But he was very militant against it. And he was a pro-Lansbury, pro-Attlee man, anti-MacDonald. Mm. I remember hearing anti-MacDonald once. I wasn't impressed. I was about 16. Mm. I thought there was a facade there, but there was only just an impression.
Difficult not to develop a facade, I suppose, leading that party. It's a very difficult party to lead, isn't it? But still. But, I mean, your elder sister...
No, I'm the elder sister.
Sorry, your younger sister. Do you think it would be a good idea for me to see her? I mean,
well, she's not the slightest interested in politics.
Isn't she?
She's had a hiatus in her... She's a grandmother five times over. And
is she?
Left her husband. She's very modern, very trendy. She's taken up with someone else, and I think that's upset mother rather. As far as she's been able to take it in, she's deteriorated in the last month or so since this business started about 6 months ago. Mother's very Victorian in her attitudes to that sort of thing.
Yes. Of course, that is one of the major differences between women's lib and and the suffragette movement, really.
So I don't think you get any change out of Alice at all. Mm. And her own children are both... Dale's a university graduate and the other one isn't. And they're not in the slightest bit interested in politics. My brother's children aren't either. Helen, she's done very well. She has a degree in physics, I think. She's teaching at a nurses' college. She's taking child development, which is near Nottingham. And her husband's head of the graphics department at Sheffield Polytechnic. And my...
So there's quite a strong educational connection in the whole family.
Yes, I was going to say my nephew, who's 38 next birthday, he was here last weekend. He was at Cambridge, and he's now one of the music staff at Edinburgh University. He runs the Edinburgh Symphony and Edinburgh Chamber Orchestra. So know, they've done quite well.
Yes. What were your parents' attitudes to education? I mean, of their own children.
They wanted the same for boys and girls, and they believed that everybody should. I mean, free education. They believed in it, and they believed in it being to as far as possible. Like 16, they'd have both been delighted at knowing that it had reached 16, the school leaving age. But in the event, we had private education. We went to a private school. And then I really persuaded the mother to let me go to the high school. And then he lost his money, and all three of us were sent to a progressive school at King's Langley in Hertfordshire.
Oh, yes.
One of my uncles paid the fees. King's Langley, it was run on Rudolf Steiner principles.
Oh,
it was
yes.
a mixed school, and they had what they called a main lesson every fortnight, the morning main lesson, and they had visiting people. I remember one of them was a man called White Fox, John Hargreaves, who ran the Kibble-Kif movement, which was like a Boy Scout movement in this country. And that school, I understand, went on for some years after we left it. Then we came back, and my brother and I went to the high school, and Alice went to the Kirby School, which was the other Mills Grammar School.
The high school at
Middlesbrough.
Yes, Middlesbrough, yes.
We lived in Middlesbrough.
Yes. So they obviously felt, I mean, they cared about education.
Oh, very much so.
Very much so, yes.
And you see, they were both on the education committees when they were... my father was a councillor for a short time. But he was, I told you, never attended to details. Apparently, when he was about 26, he had a business in Newcastle and he went bankrupt. And he never tied up the ends. You know, they were supposed to get themselves out of bankruptcy. And when he eventually lost his money the second time, it was... spread all over the local gazette that Mr. Charles Coates was a bankrupt. He'd never got himself out of bankruptcy. So that was, in those days, regarded as a heinous crime. And we realised we were no longer being invited out to people's houses and that kind of thing. But for Mother, it must have been awful to be ostracised after she'd been accepted as somebody socially very... desirable and adequate, you see. But she stuck to the Labour Party, and after my father's death, she used to go to meetings. She was an honorary member of the Trades Council and the Municipal and General Workers and that sort of thing. She really did keep in with all the organizations where her brain power was called on.
How did the crash sort of affect her personally? And did she then go out to work or something? Or?
No. But for a very short time after I got married, I think she was afraid that she'd have no income in the event Peter and I did what we could for her. But she became organiser for the National Union of Women Teachers in the area, which went as far south as Doncaster. She did a year. I think she, you know, they got about £250 a year or something at that time for it. But she couldn't keep it up, and it was during, there was a blackout. So she came back home and took in a paying guest and, you know, just sort of managed.
Presumably your way of living dropped dramatically,
Well, the house where we lived, it was a beautiful house, Agecroft, the second one in which I lived, they began to take in paying guests. And we had 1.5 acres of land and tennis courts and all that kind of thing. But Mother couldn't, she just lacked that drive to make it pay. So we eventually left that and went to another house, the Grey House, which she also ran as a boarding house, but as I say, she couldn't make it pay. Then my father, who'd got £5,000 for Agecroft, which was a lot of money in those days, put it into a nursery garden business, put a manager in. The manager cheated him. And in the event, you know, that went. And then my aunt Marion, Mrs. Coates Hansen, employed him as a sort of commercial traveller.
I see.
And my uncle, who was about the same age, they're both very elderly men, used to drive the car. My father couldn't drive. And they had an accident on the first father sitting in the back of the car, was badly concussed and died within a week, 1939, working till the last minute because he thought he'd let mother down, you see. Oh,
did she in any way rub it in, I mean, with him?
Well, I suppose she did in a way, indirectly. He knew that he was being criticised. You know, these things sort of build up. And there was 18 years difference between them. I think he never... I remember I was out walking with him once and I was very indignant and I said to him, you know, shouldn't take up this attitude. And he said, now, don't you say anything. He said, I always remember the idealism of the early days, which I thought was marvellous because he was getting... he knew he was being criticised at the time. But this is all.
It's one of the human sort of things
it's
that happens.
The human
isn't it? I mean,
things.
Yes.
You hear about people's public life and you don't
yes.
know so much.
And there
about
is actually very often, I mean, a contradiction isn't that among people who are very active in reforming causes and
yes.
so on, they're tremendously good in general,
yes.
but often.
But they've got to have a
good.
Place where they can.
Yes, I mean, the energies they devote to doing
yes.
good to other people, they deprive their children in a sense.
Yes.
Did you ever feel that, actually, as children, that the attention that she ought to have been giving to you was really going in
no.
public life? I mean,
no, because when we were little, we had governesses and nurses, you know, who acted as buffers. It was a really Victorian household in that way, and they used to entertain at night and that kind of thing when we'd gone to bed. We lived upstairs, you know, in the night nursery and that kind of thing. I read books now, you know, that period, and references to it, and I think, yes, I've lived through that, I understand
very
it.
Interesting, yes. You say you, in a sense, were a bit frightened of her. I mean, were your brothers, were your, was your brother and sister frightened
well,
of
her?
Well,
my brother wasn't. He used to always take his own line. He was really obstinate. I don't know whether Alice was frightened. I think she understood that she was the favourite. But I always remember when we were at the school in King's Langley, all three of us were there, and the younger ones had to go to bed about 7:30, and the older ones could have another half hour. But my brother was always interested in machinery, he was interested in animals. He used to take dead mice to bed with him and that kind of thing. He took a watch to pieces one night, and there was a woman from Germany, I expect she'd be what you call an au pair today, who was supervising us as we did our jobs in the evening, homework or whatever it was. And Peter's turn to go to bed came. And he said, I'm not going. I must finish this watch. And she was furious about it. But he was up another hour before he'd finished the watch. And he'd be about 10 then when he went to bed. And that was typical of Peter. He always did what he wanted. Was a communist for a while, but I think when he first got his first teaching post, it was indicated to him that it was unwise, and he left them and became a member of the Labour Party. But he belonged to the John Strachey generation, well, not that generation, but that type of person who were very, very far left and never sort of got rid of it. I'm sure he would have been the headmaster if it hadn't been for that. Before he died, you know.
So he had a sort of personal independence which, enabled him to sort of resist
yes.
domination by
yes.
your mother. Yeah.
And he was even more dogmatic, I think, than my father in political and social criticism.
But if you were slightly frightened of him, was it because she was a disciplinarian or a martinet or
well, I don't
what?
Know.
I mean,
I say she was good looking, but she suddenly, if you remember those photographs, a cold look would come over her face, most disapproving. Mind you, she may not have intended it. We went sometimes to the theatre, and we were rolling in the aisles, and Mother would sit there, you know, never flickering an eyelid, and we'd think, oh dear, we shouldn't be laughing, and that kind
oh
of
dear,
thing. It was
so
just
awful.
That, it was a strange attitude. And my friends, and even when I began to teach, I invited colleagues to the house. And years afterwards, someone said, you know, we were terrified of your mother. That's why we never went on coming.
She She was an impressive-looking woman, was she? I suppose that might...
Impressive, and yes, she was a bit like a ship in sail. She was heavily built, though she isn't now. Well, I've got some odds and ends here.
Can you remember what she was like?
Yes, she always looked the same to me. Marvellous old lady wearing this headdress, you know. She always
Antilla,
looked old.
Yeah.
I think she would be over 70 when I first met her. But she was a great character. She really was.
Was she nice to you?
Oh, yes. She stayed with us at Woolstrop House more than once. Mm. And she was kind. Mm. Just treated us as children, you know.
Yes.
I don't know. I found these last night at one of the officials of the original National Council of Women in Middlesbrough. And it faded out about 1927 and for about 20 years. 25 years there was no NCW, and then it started again without any reference to the earlier days.
Did it? Yes.
Now there's another one which I think is quite interesting.
At the Minerva Club, when you were there, what was it? What was it like?
Well, it was petty. Very much so. But
other people
I think rooms in Bloomsbury always have been. But there were single room, you know, bed-sitters. And there was a communal dining room where they served meals all day. I believe Mother had made an arrangement for me to have full board there. And I kicked against the pricks and got out and went with another girlfriend to a woman's club in Mortimer Street. And then we moved out to Golders Green and got in with Progressive Society there. And our mother was very hurt about it. Then I went to live in Streatham with another old suffragist, Mrs. Tanner.
Oh, yes.
I don't know if you've ever heard of her.
I haven't, no.
Well, Mrs. Tanner would be about between 60 and 70 when she took me in 1930 I went to Mrs. Tanner. But anyhow, the Minerva Club went on until it was burnt down, I think.
Your mother went sort of down there quite a lot, did she?
Oh, yes. She used to... She stayed sometimes at the Minerva Club. They had odd rooms. Sometimes she stayed at the Kingsley Hotel in Hart Street, Bloomsbury. I know it was 6 and 6 a night.
What was the Minerva Club? I mean, was it a sort of meeting place for suffragettes,
really?
Yes,
they had meetings night after night, and they had all kinds of meetings. Spiritualists went there, and, you know, odd societies. They would take the front room. It was all right, though. I mean, you could have your friends in, and studying. I had a minute cubicle of a room, but for what I was paying, I suppose, it was very good for London.
But it was just a sort of hostel, in a way,
yes.
Was it? I mean, they didn't try and sort of influence you in your ideas?
Oh, no,
like
I think they would have been very glad if I'd... I was inclined to be a bit shirty then, you know, these are my parents' contemporaries, and I stay with my own. But they were there, and Miss Reeves was a bit like Mother, a bit off-putting, but a very intelligent woman, of course.
So there was a dining room, was there?
A dining room, and there was another room which was a common room, but was the one that was let off for meetings and was frequently let off for meetings. So there
And then there were bedrooms upstairs,
bedrooms,
were there?
Yes, all over the place.
Yes.
And indifferent food,
But old women, on the whole, going there more. I mean, it was a...
Well, E.M. Forster used to come in. He had his breakfast there. He just lived round the corner. I remember that. And Maud Gonn.
Oh, yes.
McBride, wasn't that her name? She was a very beautiful woman. I know I saw her there once or twice. These people, and Florence Marx, who belonged to the Abbey Theatre in Dublin, one of their early actresses. Florence Marx had a room there. Some of them were middle-aged. Miss Auld, whose death is announced in one of the booklets here. You see, in the 1920s, late 1920s, those people were middle-aged women.
Yes.
They weren't old people.
Yes, but they're older than you, and you felt slightly out of place.
They were 20 years ahead of me, and I just felt that slight resentment that younger people do feel against older people.
Yes. I'm interested, you see, in what happened in the women's movement after enfranchisement, and I'm interested in, you know, how things were running. Presumably the Minerva Club was quite important in the whole women's movement.
Oh, yes,
at
yes.
At that time.
Yes.
As a meeting place, sort of thing.
Oh, yes, all kinds of people used to come there, but I think the militants would leave it alone. I don't know that Miss Lenton used to go there.
Was it a money raise, and did they make money out of it, do you think?
I don't think so. They had the property, they owned the property. Mm. And then, of course, all these things just came to an end when the war broke out, because all that part of London was bombed, you see. Mm. Very badly.
You say it was tatty, even when you knew it.
You know, carpets that were threadbare and that kind of thing. It obviously had its great days. You could see it was what was left of a very nice family house. A lot of those were family houses around there. There'd come clubs and hotels and that kind of thing.
Mm. That's interesting. I've often heard the Minerva...
Of course, even in those days, he'd had contact with India before he was a minister in the Labour government. And when I was a little girl, after he'd been with us, he used to send me a typewritten copy of his work out in India. They used to go visiting, and the accounts of their jaunts abroad, which were very interesting. And then he stopped writing to me and went on writing to Mother until... more or less the time of his death.
It's interesting because he was in the WSPU, whereas your mother was in the Women's Freedom League. So.
You can borrow these if you haven't got them. The elegant lunch, you know, with beautiful napery and glassware. And then he took us to the Adelphi Theatre to see Gladys Cooper as Peter Pan.
Did he? Was he good with children, do you think?
Oh, yes, he was very good. Yeah. They didn't have any of their own, but he was very good.
Yeah. Because she was a very emotional woman, a very attractive, emotional woman.
She didn't come across to me particularly as anything special. I only met her once, and I thought she... Oh, well, I'm sure she didn't wear a wig, but, you know, I had that sort of feeling. You know what small children...
They noticed that sort of thing. She was very deaf, actually. She had a sort of machine that she used to use, which apparently was very embarrassing to people.
Well, that's...
Coates Hanson. I mean, she was your aunt, so she's your...
My father's sister.
Yes. Mary. Yes, I see. Yes. What was the relationship between her and your mother then?
Sisters-in-law.
Yes, I really meant relationship in the sense, did they get on very well together?
They didn't. They hated each other.
No, really?
It was funny. When I was born, I lived in Woolstrop House, which was an old, rather lovely terrace house. And at the other end of the terrace lived my aunt. Was a very formidable woman, and she more or less browbeat into marriage the German partner in Ronnebeck and Company, Friedrich Hansen, who actually deed polled his name and became Friedrich Coates Hansen. Well, they lived at each end. We had a dog called Carlo, they had a dog called Queenie, both big dogs. Ours was a curly retriever. The dogs used to fight when they met, and Mother and Aunt Marion kept their distance. But they were both, I mean, Aunt Marion was a very intellectual, competent woman, and she was a counsellor for years. She was a counsellor.
In Middlesbrough?
In 1930, I've got a picture of her wearing the robes, which had been bought at that period for the counsellors. She was very intolerant. If she made an enemy, you know, it was an enemy for life.
So, I mean, they're both characters, of course, your mother and Mrs. Coates Hanson.
Oh,
so
Mrs. Coates Hanson was electric. She came into the room, you know, she was there. But she was like these people I mentioned in the National Council of Women. She believed in equality for superior people.
She agreed. Did she agree politically with your mother or not?
Well, up to a point, she belonged to the Labour Party, but in the end they chucked her out because she insisted on taking her own line. I forget what the actual occasion was, but she was given plenty of rope because my father put in a word for her over and over again. He didn't want his sister to be victimised, but in the end they said, well, she's got to go. And they dismissed her from the party, which made her feel very bitter. She didn't join the other side, but she took up her own line.
She's an independent-minded
person.
Absolutely, sort of
yes. She used to write a lot. Nothing was ever published, but she wrote reams and reams of things. And
Is there anyone who could talk to me about her? I mean, she was also, and she's a name I remember. You know,
well, only children, me, as far as I know, there are no children. Only mm. I could speak about her because her mm. brothers and sisters have gone, and unfortunately, the last person who could have talked to you about her, my cousin Nell, died just last Wednesday. He was going to the funeral on Monday, mm. and she knew them very well.
Did she? What pity.
Yes, very well mm. indeed. But the photograph that you saw there was typical of her. I mean, that is the one that's always shown. Mm. Mr. Lilly, now he might.
Mm. Now, there were a lot of entertaining.
Well, they had money. She did a tremendous amount of entertaining.
Did she?
Oh, yes. Yeah. They had all the people who came to speak for the Labour Party would come and visit. I always remember a man called Casey. That came back into my mind. He was an Irishman. He used to, he was a violinist. And he took a concert party round for the Labour Party all over the country, and Casey stayed with us once or twice. Who else did we have? They all came there.
Lansbury, presumably.
Oh, yes, Lansbury came. Well, Lansbury was very friendly with the... Aunt Marion was friendly with Lansbury's daughter, Dorothy. Mrs. Coates Henson and Dorothy Lansbury knew each other quite well.
Mm. But, Mrs. Coates Hanson married then somebody in your father's firm.
Hmm. Friedrich Hanson.
Yeah.
He was over, I think, more or less learning the business at the time.
Hmm.
And he'd been born in Denmark when it and then it was ceded. Schleswig-Holstein was ceded to Germany in the was it the
1864, the Danish
somewhere
war.
About there. Hmm. Hmm. Well, so he was a German subject when he came over. And I know my aunt had met relations of his. But he adored her from afar, sort of thing, you know. Mm. He was absolutely a carpet. I mean, she would say, "Oh, nonsense, Friedrich," in public, you know, that sort of thing. Made your hair stand on end, even small children, we felt that he was being treated rather
so
badly.
They were both queens. Were
oh,
they,
absolutely,
in a sense,
yes.
Both Mrs. Coates Hanson and Mrs. Scofield
yes,
Coates.
But Mother would never take that line up to my father. I mean,
oh, no.
They were equal in status. Aunt Marion always felt that she was up there. And everybody else was down there.
Yes, yes. Mm. What about Lillian Lenton, actually? You say she quite often came to the house.
Oh, we knew Lillian Lenton not until they'd lost their money, and then she started visiting because she was appointed WFL organiser for the North Eastern District, and in fact she used to go up to Scotland as well. And she stayed with us a great deal. She was quite a character because she was a militant.
Yes, she was.
And she was wanted when the war broke out in 1914, and she escaped. And then I think it was a general amnesty, but she was officially on the books even
That's right,
then.
Yeah.
But she'd been with the Scottish Women's Hospitals out in Serbia. She'd worked in the Swedish Embassy during the First World War when she was getting about 400 a year, which was quite a salary in those days. Then she came back and became a Freedom League organiser and worked with them until the Freedom League caved in. And then she got a few jobs, odd jobs. I know she was agent for Dow Crow's Eurythmics. And she was living on very small means then. She was an eccentric. She always used to buy her clothes at bargain sales. And the result was she used to turn up sometimes, we were almost embarrassed, in the most extraordinary clothes. But she could carry it off. And she was a vegetarian. She always spoke her mind. And then you may or may not have, perhaps it's just outside your time, but she appeared on television in a few programmes until her death a couple of years ago.
Yes, I've never actually seen the programmes because I've only got interested in this really, I suppose, the last 5 years or so.
She was very brave, Lillian.
She was
couldn't she? Put up... she wasn't afraid of anything at all. She'd started life as a professional dancer. I think she said she was in her teens before she started dancing. And even so, she had a very, very... pliable sort of body when I first knew her.
When you say she was very brave, you mean in the suffrage thing, or you do you noticed it in other
suffrage
ways?
Suffrage thing. Oh, yes. She always said what she believed in. She was absolutely a bridge addict. Anybody who played bridge with her, you know, out with a pack of cards immediately.
Was she a very intelligent woman as well? I mean,
yes, but I think it was more intuitive, really, than rational. Mm. I mean, Mother had, I would say, Mother's brain was outstanding. Lillian's was more emotional, I think.
They got on well together, these two, didn't they?
Yes, though Lillian was as critical of Mother as I have been, you know, to you.
Mm.
Incidentally, if you're using that for publication, you play it down.
Oh, I wouldn't. I won't publish anything without asking you first.
You know, personal relationships help to give you the picture of.
They
the
do.
Person.
I'm most grateful to you for talking
it's
so
the
frankly.
The public life you really want to
yes.
know about.
Yes. The thing is, I mean, what one, in a sense, what one does get from talking to people is the dimension that's not
yes.
public, and that is part of life as well. But Lillian Lenton was an interesting person. I do wish I could have been in time to meet her.
Yes, yes. Though the last time I actually saw her, I suppose, would be, what, 10, 12 years ago. She was living in somewhere, was it in Bucks? Mm. I've forgotten, I really have, but she had a flat in a big house, and I spent the night there, and I was shattered because I said I'd help with the washing up, and the washing up bowl had to be put just there, and I hadn't got to do it with a dishcloth, I had to do it with a mop, and then I had to put everything just there. You know, she'd become, certain people become addicted, don't they?
Yeah, I'm sort of fanatical
compulsion.
About them. Yeah.
Yes. And then my sister stayed with her some years afterwards, and she said, you know, it was dreadful, it really was. So I think she was going downhill.
Mm.
But to the end, she was she kept up appearances as well as she could. I mean, she must have been living on next to nothing then. I think she just got in for this, for the pension, because I know Mother was slightly older than Lillian Lenton, and in, was it 1948? When you could pay, if you were not an employee, you could pay, you could get stamps. And Mother was just outside the age range. And the result was that she never had a pension until, well, she got it at 70. She got the non-contributory. And then she gave that up because a relation, my father's sister-in-law, who had been a prima donna in America, strangely enough, very kindly remembered three indigent sisters-in-law, and she left Mother enough money, which we've invested for her. You know, she's got enough now to pay out anything she wants, and she gets the over-80s pension. Mm. But Lillian qualified to pay, and so, you see, she always got the state pension.
Yes.
And Mother was very hurt, because we'd somehow or other we'd have managed, you see, to pay for it for her.
Yes.
But she was just ineligible, so
Yes, that's very interesting. What did Lillian Lenton look like, actually, apart from these clothes?
Well, you saw that picture.
Yes.
Well, she used to dye her hair blatantly. I mean, lots of women who get older use a rinse, but Lillian dyed it. And then she would let it grow, and you could see, you know, about an inch of grey hair.
What was she like to talk to? I mean...
compulsive talker.
Was she?
On and on and on and on and on. And she used to read the most ghastly romantic novels kept them from the library. But she had a lot of... Oh, and she also worked for the Tail Waggers Club for a while in Edinburgh. She had a friend. Dickens was her name. But she was connected with the women's movement. She used to go out and live, spend time with her. And Lillian worked for the Tail Waggers Club. She got all kinds of sort of odd jobs which kept her going. And I know Mother went up to visit there in the 1920s, late 1920s. Miss...
Not Billington Gregg.
Oh, no, 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 no. I remember Mrs. Billington Gregg.
Do you really, do tell me what you remember about her, because she is a most interesting woman, actually.
No, I just remember her. I suppose the first time I went to London, I was 10 years old, and we stayed at the Kingsley Hotel, but we came to the Minerva Club, and there were a lot of these people there. And I was introduced to them one after the other. Great resentment on my part. This is my small daughter, you see. Small daughter. Didn't like that at all.
No.
But I do recall them. And as Mrs. Howe Martin was not.
Oh, yes. Did you see much of her in the family?
No.
Because she was very prominent.
Because one thing, you see, my parents entertained, but we had nurses and governesses. Children went to bed early, and they were out of it. We were rarely called down. We met them during the day, but only if invited. I mean, we had our own room where we ate, and children were seen and not heard in those days. Very much so. That was impressed into us, and I think that was, in a way, what caused my awe of Mother, even to being grown up.
Because you never really were intimate with her, in a sense, no.
And it was always, if you were inclined to query anything, I am your mother, therefore I am right, you know, that sort of thing.
Mm.
Which we accepted. It was just the way of living those days. Like children today, they just can't conceive that such times ever existed.
Did you actually have meals as a family together?
Later on, of course, we did. When there were no longer nurses and governesses, we had a number of au pair people, French girls. I keep in contact with one of them. In fact, my husband met them in Paris, and we're hoping we might be able to get across if we can afford it. We're going to take the caravan across. This year, they have a place in the Gorge du Town, which we hope to visit, but I don't know. Depends what Mr. Healy does on Tuesday.
Right. But in the family, and what did you have sort of arguments and discussions about politics when you were a child?
Up to a point, but Peter was the most vocal in those. Peter was, in a way, I suppose, I used to be irritated because he was like his father. He could talk anything round, do anything with statistics, talk anything round to his own way of thinking. And I couldn't.
So he rather held the floor, sort of thing.
Yes, much to my annoyance. And Peter also took up the line that certain things should be done by the girls in the family and not by him. I remember when we had this boarding house, I was home once from university and I was shelling peas in the kitchen. I said, come on, Peter, lend a hand. Oh, no. Women's work. I was infuriated. But
I'm surprised your mother would have stood for that.
Oh, well, she didn't put in an appearance, of course. She never shelled the bees.
What was she like with money, actually? I mean, presumably she... Well, in fact, the implication is she wasn't very good with money.
Well, I don't think she could have been in those days, but I know she tried after they'd lost it. She tried. But I would say, knowing how careful I have to be when you go shopping today, that she can let it slip a bit. But then I think she had a raw deal when she first got married. I think it was one of the periods when the father hadn't got much fluid cash. And I know when they went on their honeymoon, she said she had to pay for the accommodation, which rather took her aback. They stayed in a hotel somewhere. He only thought of things in the grand style, and you know, £1,000, £2,000, but when it came down to £1, £2, £5, that was her lookout.
Anyway, they both seem slightly impractical as regards day-to-day affairs.
Yes, though that was one thing that Mother would never, ever admit. Sometimes we used to have rows, and I would say that I thought she could have been a bit more careful, you know, how people do have rows in families. She always, to the bitter end, had maintained that, well, it was not true that she did this, that, and the other. And it wasn't so. I think she was, by disposition, slightly impractical. She was very generous. If she'd had money, you know, she never denied us anything. But she isn't generous now. She Manchester. Like all old people, she thinks she has nothing, and she has more than enough, but she thinks she has nothing. So. Mm.
You say she had this morning room where all her letters and things were.
Yes.
Did she sort of, you presumably had breakfast, did you? I mean, I'm just looking back into your childhood, really.
Yes.
Did she then retire into her morning
yes.
room?
Yes. Actually, in Woodstrop House, there was rather a nice dining room, and there was an archway which was curtained off, which led into her morning room. And there was also a way out from the morning room into the garden. It had windows on two sides. And once Mother was in the morning room, nobody went near except my father. You know, it was curtains for the rest of us. We kept upstairs or wherever we were. It was very much the grown-ups and the children. There was a tremendous difference. Distance between in those days.
And she would then be interviewing people, would she, writing letters?
Oh, yes, sort of visitors came and she wrote and letters. And
then you'd meet again for lunch, perhaps, would you, as older children?
As older children. Well, we never had lunch, we never had meals with them at Woodstrop House. We were always in our nursery.
Mm.
We began to have meals with them in Agecroft. Agecroft was named after a place which had belonged to an uncle of hers near Manchester, Uncle Timothy. It was an old house called Agecroft, connected with a coal mine, and the Americans took it lock, stock and barrel in between the wars to America. Anyhow, she retained the name in the house that we next went to live in.
I see.
Incidentally, quite a few addresses and things are in those.
Yes, well,
I think we'll have to